Welcome to the TWIML AI Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Charrington. Hey, what's up, y'all? We have got a super special treat for you today. Not only do we have a great conversation in store for you, but I'm excited to announce that we'll be premiering today's interview on the TWIML YouTube page. If you can join us this afternoon, that is Thursday, April 16th at noon U.S. Pacific time, you're in for a real treat. My guest is Kwok Lay, the prolific Google research scientist who's been at the forefront of the company's many research accomplishments in automating machine learning and deep learning. Kwok and I will be on hand in the chat answering your questions about the interview and the many awesome topics that we discuss, like Google's recent AutoML Zero paper, their new MENA chatbot technology, and Kwok's extensive work on neural architecture search and self-supervised machine learning. To join us, just head over to the TWIML YouTube page at youtube.com/TWIMLAI. Hit the subscribe button and then hit the bell to turn on notifications. YouTube will let you know when we're about to get started. If you can't join us for the live airing and chat, the podcast is here for you right after the bump. Feel free to send over your questions via Twitter. I hope you can join us for the session today, and I'm looking forward to your feedback about this new format. All right, everyone, I am here with Kwok Lay. Kwok is a research scientist at Google. Kwok, welcome to the TWIML AI Podcast.
Hi, everyone.
It's great to have you on the show. I've followed your research for your work for quite some time, and I'm looking forward to digging into some of the new things that you're working on. But before we do that, I'd love to have you share a little bit about your background and how you got started working in machine learning.
Okay, so I was born in Vietnam. I did my undergrad in Australia. And in my second year of my undergrad, I started a summer project doing machine learning with Alex Moller back in Australia. And back then, I was playing around with kernel methods. And then I did my PhD at Stanford on, you know, a lot of deep learning back in the day when deep learning was not very cool. And that's around 2007.
Okay.
And around 2011, I did a summer internship at Google. And that was when Google Brain Project was kind of founded. So when I was there, that was Andrew Ng and Jeff Dean and Greg Corrado was there. And okay. I was the intern. So we started out quite small.
That sounds
That's
awesome.
Quite cool. Yeah. And then I did some of the, you know, scaling up neural networks with the Google Brain folks. And then, you know, and then after 2 years, I did some work on machine translation with Ilya and Oreo. Vignal, he's now at DeepMind, or Ilya is now at OpenAI, and we developed some of the end-to-end translation methods. And around 2016, I started looking into more like, you know, AutoML, neural architecture search.
Yeah.
And more recently, I looked into more like, together with AutoML, I also look into semi-supervised learning and so on.
Awesome. Awesome. Now, you mentioned early on doing work with Alex Mola. Was he, was this before he was at Carnegie Mellon, or was he visiting in Australia?
He was a professor in Australia.
And, oh, really?
I went to a university in a small area in the capital city of Australia called Canberra.
Canberra?
And he was, Canberra. And he was a professor there doing research. So I thought, you know, I have been long very interested in AI and machine learning. And I took, before that, I took a class in data mining and so on. And I thought, you know, it's a little bit boring, but machine learning, the ability to actually learn is actually super fascinating. So I contacted him, and he was doing like kernel methods. Machine learning, and we worked together for maybe a few years. Yeah. Wow. Before wow. he went to America and then CMU and Amazon.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. So a lot of your recent work has been focused on this idea of automating machine learning and neural architecture search to allow machines to find the best deep learning architectures and the like. You know, talk a little bit about how you arrived at working in that area and what some of the motivations were for getting started digging into that problem.
Yeah. So I've been long interested in this idea of self-improvement. Machines should be self-improving itself, or machine mm-hmm. learning, right? And even when I started doing kernel methods with Alex, I always ask him, how the kernel bandwidth and so on, how some of the hyperparameters in kernel methods decided. And, apparently they decided by using things like cross-validation and so on. Mm-hmm. And then when I work on kernel methods, neural networks, my hope is to make the hyperparameters go away. But it turns out it's the opposite. So if you look at a convolution neural networks, it has a lot of hyperparameters, right? Like mm-hmm. How many layers you want it to be, and how many channels you want it to be, and what are some of the size of hyperparameters and so on, a kernel width.
Not to mention all the training parameters.
Yeah, learning rate. And as researchers develop more and more techniques for neural nets, there's more decisions that you have to make. Mm-hmm. And I feel like this is like a problem that can be helped by a little bit of automation. Mm-hmm. So I observe a lot of my colleagues at Google when they design neural networks, and I ask them about the principles of designing neural networks. And you started out having some really solid principles, like you add skip connections so that gradient can flow through the network and so on. But as you tune the network harder and harder, you no longer have the principle. It's around trial and error, right? You try this a little bit and it seems a little bit better. So you try that more. So I think that is something that may be ready for automation. So even during my grad school, I already thought about trying this, but I thought, maybe we didn't have enough compute, because training a net already took me days. So when I saw that you can train neural nets in 30 minutes or something like that, on CIFA, I thought, oh, maybe this is the right time to try this. So that's when I started doing this neural architecture search in 2016.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that, even with all of the compute resources of Google, you had to wait until the time was compressed enough in order to be able to tackle the problem.
Yeah. Turns out that to get really good results, you want the networks to be really big, mm-hmm. and that will take a long time to train. Yeah, and it's funny coming from me that we have so much resources at Google, but training neural nets is still taking a long time. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So maybe talk about the first steps in that area. Did you jump right into neural architecture search, or was that an end stage or an end result of this work?
Well, I work on some of the related ideas on and off since 2012, like playing around with how to do better hyperparameter tuning for neural mm-hmm. networks. And none of that is really published because I didn't have good results. I didn't have enough compute and so on. So I tried it on and off. Over the time, every year I would set out some time to try this idea for a few months, and it didn't work very well because lack of compute and so on. And then around 2016, I met Beritsov, who is my colleague now at Google, and he's very talented. So we say, oh, let's try this idea of using like a reinforcement learning to generate a network, like a little layer in a network for for a CIFA model. CIFA model is already at that time, you could say that, you know, trained in a few, depends on how where you want it to be, but, you know, from 30 minutes to a few hours. And that seems like about the right amount of time to get this going. And my prediction is that you have to train maybe either between from 1,000 to 10,000 of models. And I did a backup envelope calculation and I thought, oh, this might be the right time to do it. But, you know, I have tried this, some of these related ideas in, you know, much before that.
So you're doing CIFAR, which is image recognition or object detection and images. When you say you're doing tens of thousands of models, is that part of the optimization process that you're describing here? You're expecting that you're going to need to do 10,000 in order to optimize the hyperparameters?
Yeah. So in this process, you have a controller, which is also a machine learning model, right? And every time it makes an update, that's basically, it has to try training one model to convergence, one CIFAR model to convergence, and it will take the signal from the convergence of the CIFAR model. You know, maybe the CIFAR model will get 70%. So that 70% will be used as a signal to make one update for the controller, one update, right? So typically, machine learning models take a long time to train. So it requires, you know, 10,000 of updates. So that's basically the number of models that we had to try.
You know, how do you distinguish between like doing your hyperparameter optimization and kind of architecture search? Because there is a varying degree of complexity in trying to come up with these new architectures. Yeah, and your more recent work on this is like using evolutionary algorithms and the like to do this. Can you maybe talk through kind of the progression of complexity that you went through?
Yeah. So the first project that we did was architecture search for like a CIFAR model. Okay. And that was already very expensive back when we did it. And we didn't choose hyperparameters. We didn't choose hyperparameters like learning rate or weight decay or dropout. We just focus on architectural hyperparameters, basically, you know, number of layers, what kind of layer do you use in what stage in the network. And that's already took us like almost a week for every time we try this. It takes like a week on a few hundred GPUs. So after that, we moved to ImageNet. And because ImageNet, the network is bigger, we decided to use this idea called transfer learning, which is basically find a module that works well on CIFAR 10 and transfer it to ImageNet, because searching directly on ImageNet would be very difficult. It's very expensive. Now, in parallel with that, we also try a lot of methods in not only in reinforcement learning, and but also in evolution. And we also observe that evolution does as well or even better than reinforcement learning. So we slowly adopt more evolutionary methods.
Any intuition for why evolution works better than reinforcement learning?
Oh, I see. So evolution is very flexible and very easy to implement, right? For example, in evolution, you just need to decide mutation and crossover. Mutation meaning you have a network and then you just change it a little bit. And a crossover meaning take two networks and mate them. So implementing evolution is actually quite easy. Now, in contrast, reinforcement learning, because we're not experts in reinforcement learning, so we try a lot of reinforcement learning methods. Like we started out with reinforce, and then we tried it something like PPO and so on, and TRPO recently. And they're good, but you know, they also require a fair bit amount of tuning to get working very well. And on the other hand, evolution seems to be very flexible in terms of implementation. And it also, one thing that evolution does quite well is that it's easy to diversify the models. So you can just try to in reinforcement learning, one thing it happens, it will zoom in into a particular area in the search space and find and optimize a particular model. Whereas in evolution, it will diversify the population over time. It's easy to control the diversification process to get better models. So we use more evolution methods now. Okay, so in the second project, we already found one network that was kind of state of the art in computer vision, on par or slightly better on the state of the art of ImageNet. So that was super exciting because we didn't think that it was possible. And then after that, we realized that this transfer learning has a problem that, you know, you transfer the cell and maybe the kind of things that you want on CIFA and the kind of cells that you want for ImageNet is quite different. So we started searching on ImageNet directly. Basically, you search a model on ImageNet directly, but that became super expensive. You know, our back of our envelope calculation, it would take a few months for this to finish. So we realized that maybe one idea that we can have is search on small scale, search a smaller model on CIFAR. Let's say, instead of searching the biggest model possible that you can find, search for a small model, right? Like that print only like 5 epochs in, you know, 8 hours or something like that, right? So that's small. And after that, after we found a good model, we figure out a way to scale it up to big size. So basically make it deal with larger image or make it deeper or make it wider.
And is that scaling it up in a learning way or scaling it up?
Scaling up in a learning way.
Okay.
Scaling up in a learning way. So the second stage of scaling up, basically what we did was, you know, develop like we learn the way that we should be scaling up. And it looks like it works very well. And that became something called EfficientNet. Now it's been used quite a bit in various places, at Google and in academia. And the smallest network that we found turns out to be super helpful for mobile devices. So people, because the network, small network seem to be quite fast for mobile devices. That became something like MobileNet V3 at Google. And after that, we say, you know, okay, now that we can get state of the art on ImageNet, but the problem is that a lot of building blocks that we used are very much building blocks that are pre-described by human experts. Let's say we have to make use of the ReLU layer designed by human expert, or we make use of convolution layer designed by a human expert or batch norm layer designed by human experts. So we say, can we design everything from scratch? Basically, assume that we know a NumPy library. Like NumPy is just basically just, you know, matrix vector multiplication and a bunch of nonlinearity. Can you use a NumPy library to evolve the concept of machine learning? And that became something like AutoML 0.
AutoML 0.
Which basically, that's AutoML 0. And that's basically the thought process behind it. In AutoML 0, we didn't get state of the art yet. But what's exciting about it is it generates a program from just matrix vector multiplication and to do machine learning, which is super exciting. And I hope that using this method, we can discover new fundamental building blocks for machine learning.
Yeah, if anyone listening hasn't taken a look at any of the blog posts or the paper for AutoML 0, really interesting. There's one particular diagram that I've seen a couple different versions of it, but it kind of walks through the process that this algorithm takes to learn a model and shows the various steps that that it introduces and as well as the program that it outputs. And it's super interesting. You know, talk a little bit about this idea of, you know, having this model work by evolving a program. Where did that come from? a lot of what we're doing is all software, it's all programs, but this in particular is like arithmetic operations that in a very kind of simple way define all the steps that are used to evolve these algorithms.
Yes. If you think about machine learning experts are doing nowadays, is that basically they look at a computer program, use TensorFlow, right? Mm-hmm. They look at TensorFlow or PyTorch, and they have a bunch of layers, and then they figure out to write a computer program, to write a new program to do machine learning. Let's say you want to do forecasting or something like that, right? Basically, you look at how people use LSTM, and then you put together a computer program to do forecasting. Now, the act of writing that program is still now not learned, right? So basically, it's basically human expert knowledge. And changing that program can affect the quality of the model greatly. Now, stepping back a little bit is that program, the program you just put, assume a lot of knowledge about machine learning, right? The fact that the concept of gradient, backpropagation, is assumed during this process, right? Because the automated differentiation is built in into TensorFlow and PyTorch. So we say that maybe what we can do is just step back a little bit from PyTorch and TensorFlow and start it from NumPy. And using NumPy, can you put together a small computer program that can do CIFA classification or something like that. In the setup that we have three functions. So one function is setup, meaning that, it's like a DNA that you start with, right? And then there's a predict function, meaning that whatever you have learned, you have to use it for survival, right? So you have to given a situation you're in, you have to make some prediction. And then the third function is the learn function. It has to learn so that the predict function is better over time. So there's only this template have only three functions: setup, predict, and learn. And AutoML0 has to fill in the rest of the program, the rest of the instructions within these building blocks.
Right. It's starting with those three functions being totally empty.
Yeah. It started out with these three functions totally empty. So at the beginning, it will start it amazing, right? At the beginning, it will do nothing. So most of the programs will be garbage. So you have no signal at all. Mm-hmm. You have no signal at all. So by some random luck, right, it will find some kind of dot product, linear kind of layer that somehow does more than better than random, just slightly better than random, right? That's just basically the predict function does a little bit better than random. Mm-hmm. And then it will basically slowly put together one more layer to become like a neural net. And then it will invent the concept of gradient. So over time, it will come. It started from a very small program that is like linear to going through many, many steps to eventually do a neural network.
And I referenced this diagram. If I'm understanding the diagram correctly, you're identifying all these points where the algorithm evolves these techniques that humans do now. Like it eventually figures out how to do SGD. It eventually figures out like ReLU and other things, and it figures out techniques like gradient normalization and stuff. Am I reading that correctly? That this is all stuff that has figured out?
Yeah. So basically, if you put it in the whole sequence, the first step it will find like something like linear model. It find loss clipping. It will find learning rate, and it will find ReLU, and it normalizing the input norm, the gradient, and then having bilinear interaction. things like that. So things that, you know, like over the time in the last maybe 30 years of neural networks evolution, which is kind of interesting because we never set out to tell the model that they should follow our own evolution process of developing model, but somehow it found very similar trajectories of developing model, just like the way human expert would do it.
So that I understand, there's no kind of priors, there's no like recipe book or techniques that are given to the model, the algorithm at all. It's figuring out all of this from nothing. Or,
you know, So the caveat is that AutoML Zero has access to 64 functions from NumPy.
Okay.
Right. There's some bias here. So these 64 functions from NumPy, because the way that linear algebra works is very in favor of neural nets, right?
Yeah.
So it will tend to develop things like neural net because of linear algebra. But so that's the only thing.
There's a dot product there for it to use. Eventually, it's going to try and use it on some stuff.
But it would be hard for it to find something like trees because, you know, NumPy doesn't have the functions that kind of suitable for trees.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it's NumPy, you can argue that NumPy is like a library that's very suitable for neural nets, right? So it will evolve things that eventually look like a neural net. Now, what's surprising is that the whole process of developing models that started from linear and then putting developing learning rate and normalizing the gradient and things like that, it looks very much like the evolution, our own evolution process of developing machine learning models.
Has this allowed you to see future techniques that we may learn to apply?
We haven't found anything extremely novel in the sense that, like, we haven't seen it before, mm-hmm. but we have found something that that we haven't looked into more closely. So, in particular, it found this bilinear layer that normally, if you do a neural net, you would take x multiply by some w, and then you apply some non-linearity.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what we found during AutoML Zero is that it prefer x, w, x. So, and then apply some non-linearity. So that basically what it say is some kind of bilinear interaction, right? And mm-hmm. apparently this concept has been developed by other colleagues at Google, but we didn't know it before our project. So we are in the process of trying out this layer on larger problems, but it looks like that layer is actually quite promising.
Interesting.
So the other thing is the concept of gradient normalization. So basically, you take the gradient and then you normalize it before you make the update. So mm-hmm. this is not something new. So people have done this before, but it's not very popular.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe one thing is that we are also trying this on bigger networks now ourselves. But if you can think about this process, it will aid the process of discovering either new idea or mm-hmm. discovering old ideas, but we actually overlook because we have so many ideas in machine learning that
right.
we tend to overlook them. So. But some of the recent data look promising, some of the ideas that it found.
Do you think there's an opportunity to use a technique similar to what you did earlier with CIFAR, where you apply AutoML Zero in a small way and then scale it up to bigger problems or networks?
Yeah, we're still thinking about how to do it effectively, but mm-hmm. Basically, you're right. So the problems that we did in AutoML Zero is like it's not even CIFAR, it's a downscale CIFAR. It's a mm-hmm. small version of CIFAR. So, and then, you know, the concept like gradient normalization or things like bilinear interaction is something that it found. And then we can take some of these layers and transfer into big problems. Now, unfortunately, the problem in CIFAR, it's so downscale that we cannot present it like an image. So it's just only 1D. And in 1D, you cannot find things like convolutional neural networks. So that's a limitation. But in the next step, we're trying to make it make it see an image rather than just a 1D image. Mm-hmm. Now, that's one aspect, which is basically how to scale this more effectively, which we did it before. The other thing that we did is to zoom in into a particular aspect of the neural net, and can you do better? So related to this is the paper that we published a couple of days ago on evolving a better activation and normalization layer. Mm-hmm. So in a neural net, people use this layer called BashNorm and ReLU a lot, right? This is in ResNet. If you use ResNet, you have BashNorm and ReLU. And then there's a skip connection, right? And we say, let's fuse this into a single layer and search for a new mathematical operation to replace this BashNorm and ReLU. So we accept the rest of the network, but we search for a mathematical operation to find a new layer. And it seems like to find a very good layer as a replacement. And it works better than BashNorm and ReLU.
And is the motivation there primarily network performance, or is it computational, or what is driving you to focus on those particular layers?
BashNorm and ReLU, one thing that BashNorm ReLU is a good thing about it, it is it allows you to train with very big batch size, right? But when it's very small batch size, it doesn't work very well. So it's a layer that, you know, Google would like, but most data scientists would not like, because it's, you know, you don't have a big computer to train with a big batch. Mm-hmm. So there's a replacement called GroupNorm and ReLU, which is very good, but it works very well on small batch size, but on the big batch size, it's still a little bit worse than BashNorm. So it's still confusing to many people what layers to use, even at Google. So developing a new layer is that, first of all, BashNorm ReLU is, if it can be a good replacement for BashNorm and ReLU, that means the layer can be used by both internal researchers and external researchers well. And the second thing is BashNorm ReLU helps training. It stabilizes the training a lot. It speed up the training. So we use it a lot in our work. So we really want to improve on that aspect. Mm-hmm. It plays a huge role. There's a paper where they just say that you just train only the BashNorm layers and don't train the convolutional nets, and you still can get a good performance. You know, it's not great, but it's good performance. It means that, you know, these layers play a very good, important role.
And is that paper talking about training those layers, only those layers from scratch, or fine-tuning only those layers?
Training those from scratch.
And so is the idea that you're applying techniques like what you've done at AutoML0 to finding these new layers, or is that a totally separate approach?
Oh, it's highly related. And I would say, you know, it's an application of this idea of AutoML0.
Cool. And you've also been working on semi-supervised or self-supervised learning recently. Can you describe some of that work and how it relates to this stuff?
Yeah, sure. So I've been working on this automated machine learning and automated architecture design and so on. And I gave talks, right, like about my this new development, and a lot of people came to me and complained. They say, you know, you automate the design of the neural networks, but I have more data than you, so I beat you. So I say, oh, that's a good point. So I thought about, okay, automate machine learning is cool, but can you automate the labeling process? Can you automate labeling, right? Because most people would prefer to have more data, because more data is very important, right? I don't mean that architecture is not important, but having more data is also very important. Mm-hmm. So the question is, can you automate the process of labeling data? Mm-hmm. Right. So today you don't have anything. Today you basically get some unlabeled data and you give it to some human experts, and then they label the data for you, annotate the data for you. So
we've got techniques like active learning that can help you figure out the best labels, the best data to label, which helps.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, active learning will speed up that process by selectively choose the example to annotate the data. Now, so one idea that we had is the concept of pseudo labels, so fake labels. Can you take your model and generate and evaluate on the unlabeled set? And now you have weakly labeled data. But our observation is this, right? Like, can you take your own model, generate labels on a new set of unlabeled data, and then put it back, assuming that they are correct labels, and train the new model on that? Well, actually, I tried this idea many, many years ago too, and it didn't work. And the problem is that you, if you take the model and generate the new new label data, the new weekly label data, some of them are accurate. You know, a three would get a three, like a label of three. But sometimes a three would get a label of five. And this error would propagate into the new training, and it would hurt the new training. And the new training would not get better result than the old training, right? Because it's the confirmation bias going on. Now, you so I did not know any way to fix that problem. So I thought the concept of self-labeling is too good to be true. But recently we realized that there's a way to overcome this process. Is when you train the new training, you inject a lot of noise into the new student. So you have a teacher that generates labels on unlabeled data. You have a combined set of true label and weakly labeled data, right? Or pseudo labeled data. And you train new student on this new combined set. When you train the student, make sure that you insert a lot of noise. So a lot of noise in the student will, we still don't know this, how it happened yet, but the noise in the students seems to have this process that it will overcome the confirmation bias, probably because it will make the student more robust, right? Because it has
learns new... to not trust the labels all that much.
Exactly. Right. So it learned not to trust the label that much because it had to cope with so much noise. And amazingly, it actually outperformed the teacher. So the noise that we use is basically things like, you know, drop out and drop certain parts of the model, data augmentation, and super aggressively doing this data augmentation and noise. And eventually it will do better than the student. And you can just iterate the process, right? Once you have a better student, you label new data and then you put back. So we've been doing this and it seems to work very well.
What's your performance metric or your benchmark?
Yeah, so we worked on this data set called ImageNet. So when we work on this data set, the state of the art was like 82%. And then using architecture search, we've pushed it into 85%, 85.4% or something like that. And then using this auto label process, you get to 88.4, so 3% improvement. So, and keep in mind that 1% improvement on ImageNet at that high range is very difficult. And I'm talking about top one accuracy.
Is the setup here that you are you starting with your standard kind of 70%? Training and 30% test ratio, or does that matter in this? And you're having your student label the that 30%. Like, did these ratios come into play into this?
Okay, so we just follow the conventional ImageNet setup. So ImageNet has already have a split of, you know, maybe 1.2 million example of training and 100,000 for validation. And for unlabeled data, you would use a different corpus. So at Google, we have this data set called JFT that has about 300 million images.
And so then we're incorporating other data beyond ImageNet that you've labeled using a model trained on ImageNet,
yes,
that you don't have any labels for. I mean, meaning that you don't have any labels for your external data set, but you're just labeling it based on ImageNet. Some of those are going to be wrong. So you introduce the noise and it all seems to work.
So basically, So here's something that we find really surprising. There's one experiment in the paper that people did not check, but it's super interesting, is that we can propagate back images that, so ImageNet has 1,000 categories, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, some flowers, some dogs, and some cats, and so on. Mm-hmm. Now, we propagate back images that don't look like any categories in 1,000 category. So it could be like some kind of very strange animal, right? And the model would suggest like
classes that ImageNet is.
Yeah, it doesn't belong to any.
Yeah.
Any categories, and it still helps just by saying that you know, this image is not any of these categories, and this put a lot of low percentage, low probability on a lot of this category. You propagate back, it's still okay.
And that's consistent with the consistent maybe with the idea that the images are, even if they're not, you know, helping tune your classifier layers at the end, they're helping the network learn textures and, you know, low-level features better?
Yeah, so I think what is really happening is that it's just trying to learn information about natural images, right? Mm-hmm. The fact that basically you give it a label, so the teacher give it a label, and then when you do data augmentation, you ship the image a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. And then you say that the label is the same. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the probability table looks very similar. So the model has to work really hard to stay consistent in the prediction. So that's, and natural image in general is just very similar in similar ways, right? So it learns to be consistent in terms of labeling for new images. And maybe that's the reason why it's very helpful, even though the images might not have anything to do with your data set.
And you know, I'm curious in kind of articulating that intuition for what's happening. Is that based on, you know, all of your experience working with these kind of networks, or did you perform specific experiments to try to understand what the effect might be, and, you know, what were those experiments? Network introspection or any kinds of things? I'm just curious, you know, what are the kinds of things you've done, you know, to deepen your understanding of why this is working?
Okay, so we try to lower the threshold, right? So when you take your model and then label a corpus of 300 million images, mm-hmm. We have a chance to filter out low confidence images, right? So things that, you know, have very low prediction, low probability of having to be in any of the class. So we can keep 1 million images or 30 million images or, you know, 300 million images or anywhere in between, right? Mm-hmm. So we vary the threshold, and it seems like actually the threshold can be quite really low, right? It could be, you know, in the 130 million or something like that, it's still okay. Mm-hmm. And then we visualize the image that are actually very low accuracy and confident, and then we visualize them and see what they look like, and they don't apparently they don't look like anything like on ImageNet. So that's what we found, why the fact that they're helpful is very surprising, but why they are helpful we still don't know. Okay. So is this a hypothesis? We don't know.
Yeah.
Which is basically our current work is trying to analyze why it's helpful.
Okay. And what do you expect your direction to be in analyzing that?
We probably going to look into the hidden state of the neural network. And we see, you know, with this low confidence, where is it trying to make the hidden state more consistent to each other, which is basically the same phenomenon that a lot of people do in contrastive learning, in self-supervised learning, is that they also have two images. Update augmented image, and they're trying to make sure that the prediction is the same. And if you have two images of unrelated images, you make sure the prediction is different, right? So mm-hmm. I think this is what happened in here. So we're going to visualize some of the hidden state of the neural network with and without this low confidence example and see, you know, what happened during training.
Okay.
That's one direction that we think we will be doing.
Cool. You were also an author on MENA, the MENA paper.
Yes.
Were you involved in that? Can you talk a little bit about that work?
Yeah. So many years ago, I worked on something called sequence-to-sequence learning, you know, end-to-end neural networks through NLP, and that's used for translation. And I spent like 2 years after that trying to build like a chatbot to chat with me, because I always fascinate, like, can you have an agent that can talk to me, you know,
meaning
intelligent.
Slurp in all your emails and, you know, does it sound like you? Or were you trying to have a communication with the chatbot, or were you trying to replace yourself, quote unquote, with the chatbot by having other people be able to talk to your...
Both. Both. you know, just talking to computers is fascinating.
Yeah.
And so I failed. And then we ended up meeting this person called at Google, and a very great engineer at Google called Daniel. And he said, how about let's work together to make this better? And we did a lot of work on scaling up some of the models that we built. We collected huge amounts of social media data, mm-hmm. you know, people talking on the internet. And then we trained a huge model, like a model that I you know, maybe 100 times bigger than what I trained back in the day. And it can do multi-tone conversations. It started doing multi-tone conversation very well. And one of the magic moments that I really think that's truly magic is that it actually invented like a joke.
Mm-hmm.
It invented a joke. So people talk, it made this pun that, you know, horses go to Harvard. So cows go to Harvard. Cows go to Harvard and horses go to Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very fascinating.
And well, I remember it's been a while since I've looked at that one, but I remember it was the, you know, when you describe it as inventing this joke, it wasn't anywhere in the training data that you could find, right?
Yeah. The only instance of mentioning Hayward doesn't have any, there's only one instance of mentioning the word Hayward in the training data.
Uh-huh.
And we look at that context and it has nothing that looks like what we like horses go to Harvard at all.
And so what do you think was happening there? How did that work? And that's unlike what we see in kind of conventional language models, like even the big ones, they're picking up stuff that they've seen before generally, right?
Okay. So I can tell you my version. My version is the following. My version is the following. We still don't know, right? That this is, that's why I say it's a magic moment. I think, first of all, a lot of social media jokes about puns, right? A lot of, you know, like we find puns kind of funny. Mm-hmm. And in the training data, we train with bi-pair encoding, meaning that we take a word and we break it down into pieces.
Yeah.
So it's Harvard is not a word. It's
right.
Two words. Harvard. Right, and Harvard and etc. So it must have learned the concept of puns, and it would understand that, you know, Harvard and Harvard somehow is kind of related.
Mm-hmm.
So it made up this pun. So two things, right? Learning the concept of puns and learning how to put together like a new concept. And it does a lot of new things. Like it make a jokes. Like it make jokes about why chicken cross the roads and things like that. I don't remember the particular jokes. I can find it and send it to you. It make all kind of new jokes that we never found in the training data. And it's truly fascinating.
And so where do you, you know, that line of work, where do you see that going? What were the key, you know, was this kind of simply, you know, quote unquote, an instance of scaling up the training, or were there some, you know, new techniques or novel things that were developed, you know, in the model that you can see applying elsewhere?
Well, first of all, it basically tells a lot of people that scaling up is very effective. Why to build, NLP models, right? Like mm-hmm. I spent 2 years failing doing that chatbot, and then suddenly someone came along and found a solution, and the solution is kind of simple, which is basically just make the model a lot larger. Mm-hmm. We also found a lot of new interesting insights is that during the process of building the bot, we had a lot of difficulty how to measure the performance of the bot. So basically, we one thing that we want to measure is how human-like it is. Mm-hmm. Right? We want to be a bot that have a conversation like a human-like. So to measure human-like, we always want to ask human to look at a conversation that we have with a bot, because we build many models of the bots, right? Mm-hmm. Like many models of the bots. And every model, we have to look at and use human expert to look at the conversation and say, hey, mm-hmm. how human-like this is. So during that process, one thing that we observe is that as the perplexity of the model, so, you know, as you train the model better, so the objective function is called perplexity. It's mm-hmm. like a very local objective. It's basically how well you predict the next word, mm-hmm. right? And we've noticed that this objective function correlates very well with human judgment of human likeness of the bot. Mm-hmm. And then we did a real plot of perplexity, which is the local objective function, you know, predicting the next word, and human likeness, and we saw like a strong correlation. Mm-hmm. So that's basically another contribution for NLP, is that actually this local objective function, which is just predicting the next word, if you do a good job at it, turns out it's also a more global objective function, which is human likeness, how I can behave like a human. So local mimicking is global mimicking.
Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about that is that, you know, perplexity being kind of predicting the next word, what makes jokes and puns work is that the next word is a surprise compared yeah. to what you saw. So how do you get something that's good at jokes, but also is optimizing on perplexity?
Yeah, that's the reason why I say it's very super surprising yeah. That low. So this let me try to say it again. So there must be a global objective function that we all optimize. We like making fun mm-hmm. so that we can get engagement, right? Making fun, saying something meaningful, yeah. right? That's global, right? That's something that's not just optimizing the next word. Mm-hmm. But what I'm just claiming is that the local objective function is that actually just predicting the next word.
It's highly and somehow to the global.
Correlate to the global.
Right. I guess you could argue that what perplexity is doing in the case of the joke is predicting surprise. It's not like blind to the yeah. surprise, but it's predicting the surprise based on
it's the predicting the surprise. Yeah. yeah. You can say that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Kwok, for taking the time to share with us what you're up to and kind of walk us through these, you know, recent works of yours. Really, really interesting stuff.
Oh, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
All right, everyone. That's our show for today. To learn more about today's guest or the topics mentioned in this interview, visit twimmelai.com. Of course, if you like what you hear on the podcast, please subscribe, rate, and review the show on your favorite podcatcher. Thanks so much for listening, and catch you next time.